In Brisbane's Greenslopes Private Hospital, at the end of a corridor in a quiet room, Jeanette Dougal is very ill.
Nice to meet you too.
How are you?
In Townsend, this is Jeanette Dougal.
How long have you been in hospital?
Going on a month. I can't answer you too. Julianne will have to do the talking if you don't mind.
Can you hear okay?
There's bacteria in her lungs that doctors believe she picked up from the tap water in her house. Mrs. Dougal's daughter, Julianne Kiley, is by her side.
Mum has a germ in her lung that's called Mycobacterium abscessus, which was diagnosed a number of years ago, and she needs fairly specific antibiotic treatment for that.
Did Dr. Thompson indicate where the particular bug might have come from?
She believes that it's contained in the Brisbane water supply and that is how Mum has contracted it. And since the diagnosis, we've been boiling the water that Mum drinks, so she only drinks boiled water or bottled water.
Jeanette Dougal has a lung infection that looks just like tuberculosis. In fact, it's caused by a cousin of TB, a bacterium called Mycobacterium abscessus. It's considered rare, but when Background Briefing saw Mrs. Dougal, there were two other people in Greenslopes Hospital with this same bacteria in their lungs. In Queensland alone, there are more than 1,000 people being treated for diseases caused by mycobacteria. They're rare, but on the rise, and where most of the new cases are coming from has been a mystery. A Brisbane lung specialist, Dr. Rachel Thompson, who's been treating a lot of this disease lately, decided to look at the local drinking water pipes. She found several species of mycobacterium, including that nasty one, Mycobacterium abscessus. Dr. Rachel Thompson.
Having found a lot of abscessus in our water, I think that's a significant finding because it hasn't been reported in studies done elsewhere, and that particular bug is a major problem for us as clinicians. We're sort of looking at that in a lot more detail and we'll be taking that further.
Other cities in Australia, is there much work being done there?
No, there's no one really that I know of who's interested in it in Australia.
Around the country, there could be thousands of cases. But ask water authorities if there are bacteria of any sort at the kitchen tap and you'll be told there are none, or at least so few they hardly matter. The water industry funds a body called Water Quality Research Australia. Its chairman is Professor Michael Moore.
Bacteria are always going to be an ongoing issue. It's not going to go away. And the best way to make certain that we don't get any harm associated with them is to go for the zero count of any form of microorganism in water supplies, and that's fundamentally what happens.
But fundamentally, there's a problem here because Dr. Rachel Thompson's found mycobacteria in the water in big enough numbers to cause disease. The water industry's Bible is the 600-page Australian Drinking Water Guidelines. It's designed to tell water authorities how to manage all possible threats, and a new version's about to come out. Mycobacteria hardly rate a mention. National Water Commissioner Chris Davis.
Mycobacterium is an interesting one. At the moment, there's no guideline for it because there's no demonstrable connection between mycobacterium in water and disease.
But mounting evidence is making that connection harder to ignore.
One doctor said I had TB.
The symptoms are very much like TB, was it? The chronic coughing?
It's chronic. I've got a chronic cough, yes.
Not that far from the Greenslopes Hospital, in the Brisbane suburb of Tarragindi, Noel Wall has had a bad cough for years.
Which means that I've lost about 40% of my lung capacity. That's the worst part.
That same bug, Mycobacterium abscessus, is in Noel Wall's lungs. It's the same strain that's been found in his shower.
Dr. Thompson and her assistant carried out extensive tests here some months back on the water supply and the steam in the shower. They've discovered that the bug is evident in the shower steam.
Can you show me where the shower is?
Yeah, sure. Come on here. They came out and they had instruments and they took measurements of the water and of the shower spray.
Hello, I'm Ian Townsend, And today on Background Briefing, we're running the risk of alarming you about the safety of our drinking water. For just about everyone, the water is safe to drink. Every expert that Background Briefing has spoken to says Australia's urban water supplies are amongst the cleanest in the world. But keeping them clean is a big challenge. A few weeks ago, the Australian Water Commission released a report warning the water industry that it was in danger of overlooking new threats because our water systems are becoming so complex. We're building big water grids, linking dams with desalination plants and soon recycled sewage. A lot of people are dead against that, including microbiologist Professor Peter Collignon.
In Australia, where we had very low risk water, to then take your own sewage, pump it uphill and take it again through these membranes is what nobody else in the world does. Even in Singapore, which is put up as the example where they do this, they have it in a separate pipeline that is used for the computer chip industry. But it does not make sense to actually put that into drinking water until you have no other options. And this isn't my own personal view. I mean, this has been the public health standard for the last 150 years.
But others point out that the technology's changed a lot in the last 150 years. And reverse osmosis at sewage recycling plants can filter out the nasty bugs and chemicals. When the recycled water's mixed with dam water, it's all carefully dosed with chlorine to kill any bacteria left. So when it gets to your bathroom or kitchen, it's supposed to be bug-free. From the water industry, Professor Michael Moore.
The systems all work on residual chlorine in the water. You may take a sample at one point and find that you have some count, or even one count of bacteria. Further down the system, because of residual chlorine, it's quite likely you'll find zero.
So the filters can let some bacteria in, but eventually the chlorine kills it. So at some stage, the levels are so small that over, a day or so, the chlorine will wipe out whatever happens to get through.
Yeah, the withholding time in which the water is in the system guarantees that at your tap, your kitchen tap in your house, the likelihood that there will be any bacteria whatsoever is virtually zero.
But Michael Moore is talking about specific bacteria, and particularly E. coli. Our water is tested for E. coli, which is used as a sort of alarm system for other bacteria. The trouble is that the mycobacteria we're talking about are resistant to chlorine, and the water authorities don't test for them. And the link between one person's lung infection and a mycobacterium living anywhere around the house, in soil or water, has been really hard to prove. But Mycobacterium abscessus has now been found not just in Noel Wall's tap water and shower steam, but inside his damaged lungs.
Oh yes, there's a lot of damage. I've had so many CT scans and x-rays. And I think the last estimate was I've lost at least 40% of my lung capacity. So I've only got about 60% left now. So that's why I'm going in again, because if it keeps on and on, there'll be none left.
On x-rays, Mycobacterium abscessus in the lungs looks like a sprinkling of small white seeds. Noel Wall has spent weeks in hospital on liquid antibiotics, and he has to go in again because the infection is still there. He's one of 100 people being treated for mycobacterial lung diseases by Dr. Rachel Thompson at her Brisbane clinic.
Mycobacterium abscessus, the species I mentioned that is very resistant to antibiotics, we have found in the water supply and we have linked it to patients through their homes. And this is a fairly important finding because this infection, I think, is increasing. We are seeing more of it and it is very difficult to treat. And in previous studies, no one has really found a lot of it in the water supply.
I saw Noel yesterday. Did you find the bacterium in his shower?
Yeah, we did. We found it in his water supply and in the aerosols. So we used a device to collect steam from the showers and we sucked the steam onto some plates and we were able to find the organisms in the steam.
Was it the same organism that
The same organism that causes the disease in his lungs, yes.
That seems straightforward, but here's what the Australian Drinking Water Guidelines say about these mycobacteria.
There is only circumstantial evidence of a causal relationship between the occurrence of bacteria in drinking water and human disease. The low infectivity of environmental mycobacterium does not warrant standards or eradication programs.
The Australian Water Commission recently published a big review of urban water quality regulations and pointed out some gaping holes in those guidelines. It said that the guidelines weren't updated often enough, so they might miss new science. And they were put together with the help of experts who volunteered their time. They're guidelines, not laws. It's up to each state to enforce the rules, and in some cases, no one's sure who's in charge. Water Commissioner Chris Davis said he'd also like to see more testing more often in more places.
A water supply system is big and has catchments that reach out into the countryside, and there could be contamination, there could be damage to pipes, there could be cross connections, there could be process failures, there could be deliberate contamination by terrorists, for instance.
No one really knows the risks from terrorism, but that's the problem with assessing risks. You might remember a few months after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the US Defence Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, talked about known unknowns when it came to the things that might link Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, and terrorists.
That there are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
It's been ridiculed, but it's actually a neat way of describing why we're surprised when something goes wrong, when terrorists attack, or there's an outbreak of disease. Mycobacterium's one of those unknown unknowns because it hasn't been thought of as a threat. The Director of Infectious Diseases and Microbiology at the Australian National University's Medical School is Professor Peter Collignon.
That's the unknown unknowns and why we have to keep on doing testing, including looking for bugs that we don't necessarily think are pathogens, like Pseudomonas or Mycobacteria, because we can get unexpected consequences. If we find there are some bugs there that we have in the past thought are non-pathogens, we need to keep an open mind about that, do surveillance and see, well, maybe this is causing problems, at least in some people.
In Queensland, there are probably 300 new cases of mycobacterial lung disease every year. You have to be susceptible to it, and this can mean people whose immune system's not working well, or tall, thin, middle-aged or elderly women, men with a history of smoking and lung disease, and people with cystic fibrosis. The world of mycobacteria is really complex. They're everywhere. There are many species, and we come into contact with some every day. It's thought that early exposure to some of these bugs can be a good thing in boosting your immune system. Not all of them cause disease. The ones we're talking about are what's called non-tuberculous mycobacterium, or NTM, to distinguish them from the more infamous members of the mycobacterium family, tuberculosis and leprosy. NTM can cause really bad skin and lung diseases. It's happening more often, and we don't know why. In Australia and the US, there are now more cases of NTM than there are of TB. One of the world's experts in TB and NTM diseases is Dr. Michael Eisman, and he's on the line from Denver, Colorado.
The calculations indicate these patterns, that it's more common now than it was in the past. It's more common in the elderly. The number that's the reference that we use is tuberculosis. That's our reference point. And in the estimation of those of us who work in this field, most of us believe there are more NTM cases than TB cases.
Unlike TB, you can't catch NTM from someone else. They lurk in the dirt, water, and house dust, and can cause skin and lung diseases. In children, some species infect the lymph glands. There's a condition called hot tub lung, where a lung full of mycobacteria in spa steam can cause a severe allergic reaction. The source of most lung infections, though, has been a mystery, although Michael Eisman says kitchen taps and bathroom showers have long been suspected.
When I was young, we all got in the bathtub once or twice a week, whether or not we needed it. And now virtually everyone I know, everyone when I give a talk, I ask the question, is there anybody who doesn't get in a closed shower stall at least four or five times a week? And I think we all do that. So the difference in exposure to aerosols is much greater in a closed high-energy shower stall than it would be in a bathtub.
If you're young and healthy, it's not a problem. If you're susceptible in some way, a big enough dose of mycobacteria can start with a cough that won't go away. At Greenslopes Hospital in Brisbane, Dr. Rachel Thompson describes the symptoms.
Chronic cough, unexplained weight loss, some fevers and sweats, particularly sweats that might wake you up at night. Some people cough up blood from time to time. Most patients are quite lethargic, often very tired sort of patients. Sometimes people also get additional chest infections due to more common bacteria that occur on top of the mycobacterial infection.
It sounds very similar to tuberculosis. Do these people often turn up at TB clinics?
They do. They often turn up at TB clinics because quite often it's difficult to differentiate between the two. It's important to note that tuberculosis is a transmissible condition and it is contagious, spread from person to person. There's no evidence of person-to-person spread with these mycobacterial infections, but the symptoms can be quite similar to TB.
We talk about superbugs, about bacteria that become resistant to antibiotics. Mycobacteria are born with superpowers. The myco in the name means waxy, and this bacterium has a waxy coating that helps it shrug off a lot of antibiotics and live happily in chlorinated water.
We've done such a good job at killing off all the other harmful bacteria, there's more nutrient in the water supply for the mycobacteria to grow, so they tend to then take over and have a better life, so to speak, because there's no competition there for them.
So they've found a wonderful evolutionary niche, haven't they?
They have indeed. Urban water pipes.
They particularly like to breed in hot water systems. We've turned those systems down in recent years, from a scalding 70 degrees to less than 50 degrees. If you've ever fixed a leaking tap, you might have even seen or felt colonies of bacteria protected in what's called biofilm. Rachel Thompson.
Oh, like slime? Yes. You can even see it and feel it if you take the little end off your own water tap in your house. If you take the little mesh aerator off the end and put your finger inside the tap, you can feel the slime inside the tap.
And that's mycobacterium?
That's biofilm. So there are other components to biofilm, but mycobacteria like to live in there and can grow in there.
We've been told our tap water is free from bugs, but the water isn't routinely tested for mycobacterium. It makes you wonder what else might be in there that's not supposed to be. Recently, a team from the Australian Centre for Tropical Freshwater Research in Townsville was looking for sources of pollution on the Great Barrier Reef and stumbled across traces of pesticide in the drinking water of some North Queensland towns. The team's leader is researcher John Brody.
We took some tap water in some places to use as a blank, really, to run through our tests to see that we got zero. And unfortunately, we didn't get zero. And so we've got these results, actually, from towns along the coast where we've collected tap water and run it through our analytical procedures.
So you did?
We really don't know what to do with them. They're not part of our project, and they're inflammable results.
They're inflammable because what they found was atrazine, a weed killer. There's a big debate around the world about whether atrazine is harmful at all, but it's been linked to all sorts of things, from cancer to birth defects. It's banned in Europe because it tends to turn up in drinking water. John Brody says the amount of atrazine found is within the safe level set by the Australian drinking water guidelines. It was still a surprise, though, because it's not supposed to be there at all.
Compared to some overseas countries, Australia is very secretive about its tap water results. Of course, the authorities are testing the tap water all the time and their raw water that they get from the river, groundwater. The results are around. They have the results, but they're generally not publicly released. If you're inside the system like I am, well, you can get hold of them at times. But for a member of the public to get them is quite difficult, really. Generally have to go through something like freedom of information, and that's not a simple process.
Why do you think they're holding them so close to their chests?
I think the main reason they don't give the information out regularly is that they don't have to. So since they don't have to, why do it when you may have the risk that some people will be paranoid about small amounts of chemicals in their tap water, even if they're safe to drink? And since they don't, there's no legislative requirement that they publish this data, then they just don't bother.
John Brodie's talking about pesticides. The big city water authorities do publish the results of water tests. The South East Queensland Water Grid Manager puts water test results on its website every month, and there's a link to those on the Background Briefing website. But you won't find the results for pesticides. It tests for pesticides, but the results aren't published, we're told, because they're not considered high risk. The drinking water guidelines say that if atrazine is found, it has to be investigated and stopped. But it's not clear who makes sure that happens. The guidelines tolerate traces of some chemicals and bugs anyway. For instance, the guidelines say 98% of drinking water samples, that is 1 in 50, are allowed to contain E. coli. Director of Infectious Diseases at the ANU's Medical School, Peter Collignon, says that's not good enough.
I think that's potentially a catastrophic mindset that's wrong. The reality is we have lots of people who are more susceptible in society, and international water standards are that no pathogens, meaning E. coli, enterovirus, should be in the water that's supplied to people. That's the whole point of chlorination.
This is a sore point between microbiologist Peter Collignon and Michael Moore from the water industry. Michael Moore says 100% bug and pesticide free is what the water authorities want too.
We do. I mean, basically we do. Peter's just stating exactly what the aim of all water treatment processes are, and that is no organisms, no pollutants. The problem with both is that our analytical systems now are exceptionally sensitive, and so we can measure. And you, again and again, when you have evaluation of water, somebody will say, well, there's X micrograms per litre of a pesticide in it. Okay, there is possibly that amount in there, but that's something many thousand times less than the allowable daily intake. So it's a very, very small amount of material which can be measured. Basically, the water that we get supplied from the utilities is free of everything.
The water utilities in cities are becoming big businesses. Huge amounts of money are being spent to make sure there's enough water for the next drought, and that's one of the reasons why your water bills are rising. The recently completed South East Queensland Water Grid is the country's biggest water project since the Snowy Mountain Scheme. Background Briefing was given a tour of the grid by Director of Operations Dan Spiller, starting at a sewage recycling plant at Bundamba, west of Brisbane.
Hello, can we help you at the front gate?
Hi, it's Dan Spiller. I'm here to see Don Alcock.
Come in, come up to the administration building. Thank you.
This vast system of pipelines links 12 dams and a desalination plant and includes stormwater harvesting and three sewage recycling plants across 22,000 square kilometres of Queensland. It cost more than $7 billion, but it's said to have drought-proofed Brisbane. The Director of Operations for the Water Grid is Dan Spiller.
Each of the elements of our system are replicated elsewhere in the world. There are places with recycled water schemes, there are places with desalination, there's places with some stormwater harvesting. What stands out here is the way in which we're integrating them and managing them as an overall portfolio to deliver that water that's of a consistently high standard at the lowest possible cost.
It's hard not to be impressed. This grid can move water around on an enormous scale, and it's all managed from a central control room in Brisbane's CBD. Since the drought broke, the plan to put recycled effluent into Brisbane's drinking water has been shelved, and the desalination plant on the Gold Coast has been operating at a fraction of its capacity. It's now waiting for the next drought to prove it was all worth it. Dan Spiller.
I think the desalination is a core element of urban water supply systems, and I think recycled water and the potable use of recycled water will become increasingly prevalent across Australia and elsewhere over a number of decades.
We used to turn on the tap to fill a glass of water and know where it came from. In most cities, there was a dam and a waterworks, and the water came down the pipe to our kitchen. If it tasted funny, we rang the council. Now in Brisbane and increasingly in other cities, the water could come from a number of places. The Water Grid Manager is just one of six different agencies in Brisbane involved in the water system. There are agencies to store, manage, move, recycle and sell the water. around the country, water's controlled by lots of different companies and government corporations, and it's confusing. Australian Water Commissioner Chris Davis.
Well, you're not alone in expressing concern about that. It's a fairly confusing landscape at the moment. Yeah, the people in the industry are having difficulty getting their heads around it, so I hate to think what the general public would make of it.
Private companies are getting in on the act, running recycling, desalination and stormwater schemes. If you have a backyard rainwater tank, you're also part of the mix. It's not the big utilities, but the small operators who are giving the regulators sleepless nights. They have to make sure people are maintaining equipment, watching out for bugs, and not cross-connecting pipes. Chris Davis.
There's a real fear amongst the regulators that a new building in the downtown area somewhere is equipped with an internal recycling system or a stormwater harvesting system. It could be bought off the shelf. It's done as part of the building developer's push to get a 6 green star rating or a 5 green star rating. But what can and has happened is that the whole thing just got too complicated for the people to operate and they walked away from it. So you have a risk there that an inappropriately incentivised or equipped agency is in charge of something which they can't handle.
We think of water as a simple product, but it's a magnet for bugs and chemicals.
There's a level of complexity that you just can't escape in all this because it is complicated. Water is the ultimate solvent and it dissolves everything, almost everything it comes in contact with. It picks up these materials. Pathogens come from all over the place in the living world and you can't walk away from that complexity.
It's so complex that you can't test the water for everything. So increasingly, water's being treated like food and handled more carefully. Our food handling laws are pretty tough because one slip can make a lot of people sick, as happened in Germany recently. This report from the news service Euronews.
The EU has decided to ban imports of some seeds and beans from Egypt after investigators found a likely link to 2 deadly outbreaks of E. coli food poisoning in Europe. Specifically, scientists believe a batch of fenugreek seeds is the most probable cause of the outbreaks that infected more than 4,000 people. One focused on northern Germany that killed 49. The other was centred on the city of Bordeaux in southwest France. One elderly woman died there, but not from the same strain of bacterium. The European Commission didn't identify the seed company, but said all of its fenugreek seed imports to Europe since 2009 must be withdrawn from the market, tested and destroyed. The ban on imports will expire at the end of October.
How that all started is still unclear, but all sorts of things have been blamed, from Spanish cucumbers to British sprouts. The latest is sprout seeds from Egypt. That's how complicated it can get. A simple salad becomes a crime scene with international suspects. That dangerous strain of E. coli might have found its way into the German salad anywhere because one sprout or cucumber can pass through so many hands. At Queensland's Institute of Molecular Bioscience, Professor Matt Cooper studies bacteria.
It goes back to, again, how complex a society is. Back in the good old days, you'd have a greengrocer where you'd buy your vegetables and you'd have a farmer and maybe a guy in a horse and cart that would take it from A to B. So it was either the guy on the horse and cart, the greengrocer, or the farmer. These days, we have distribution systems, pre-packaging systems, companies that wash and package food, supermarkets that have distributor outlets and trucks. Then, so each one of those individual events could be the source of the contamination, including the original grower. And that goes back to which type of fertiliser they used and what type of irrigation system they use. So to produce food on the table now could maybe involve 10 to 15 different handling steps and 20 different companies. It's a detective story, and the more potential players there are, the harder it is to find the source.
So while we all try to make sure we wash our hands, our food's coming from more places and passing through more hands, increasing the risk that someone hasn't done the right thing. If something goes wrong and people get food poisoning, we use antibiotics to cure them. But this strain of E. coli in Germany is one that's evolved in recent years in an amazing way. It's swapped genes with other bacteria so it's more toxic. It's learnt how to spread more easily, and it's not easily killed by antibiotics. it's becoming as lethal as bacteria were a century ago, before we had antibiotics. Matt Cooper again.
Before 1930, more than half of Australians died of infectious disease. Now we forget that. If you went to hospital with golden staph, with MRSA, 80% of those people died in the 1920s. And in Melbourne, I saw some statistics aged between 20 and 40 years old, 30% of deaths were due to TB in that age group. Young, healthy people. So, look, we're not there now. We don't want to alarm people, but we need to start to act now. We take it for granted that antibiotics will fix us. And if you think about medical advances in the last century, I mean, the biggest one is sanitation, clean water and sanitation. That's probably saved more lives than anything else. But number two is antibiotics. And we've got this precious natural resource. We need to start to use it more wisely.
Things like E. coli are in their element in the human food and water chain. That's how they spread best. Everything they do to make us sick helps them survive and flourish.
Diarrhea is a great mechanism for spreading disease. In fact, that's how cholera and all these enteric diseases spread. If you induce diarrhea, you're going to be expelling a lot of the bacterium into the environment, into the water supply, into food, on your hands. And so diarrhea is a great strategy to spread for enteric bacteria like E. coli. The toxin actually enables it to, it's a rich food source. I mean, there are this hemolysin and the Shiga toxin, they all enable it to use blood as a source of food. And so that's a strategy to, you know, grow faster.
Matt Cooper in Brisbane. As it happens, over in Europe, one of Australia's experts in E. coli was working for the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization when the German E. coli outbreak started. Patricia Demachelier spent 20 years with the CSIRO looking at similar types of E. coli in Australia. She's now a private food safety consultant, and she's speaking from Rome via Skype.
Well, I have to admit, after a long time, I'm still fascinated by microorganisms. They're one step ahead of us all the time, and they just seem to adapt, or they're already there adapted in these environments we haven't looked at closely. But we're going to have to try and keep up with them, because as water becomes scarce, as we keep increasing our production and have to look at ways to resourcefully produce food, then we're going to have to look carefully at what the interactions are with microorganisms. And if it was possible for us to predict some of these things, it would be great, but some of them we'll learn, unfortunately, after outbreaks like this one in Germany.
We all have E. coli inside us. In fact, we walk around with about 1.5 kilograms of all sorts of good bacteria in our stomachs. We're talking about rogue types of bacteria, such as E. coli that carry Shiga toxins. Another type of toxin-carrying bacteria is cholera. We think of cholera as something we don't have to worry about in Australia because our water supply is so good. But there is a cholera epidemic on our doorstep in Papua New Guinea. Patricia Demachelier was part of a team that in the 1980s found cholera living in rivers around Sydney and Brisbane. There's no suggestion that cholera is a big risk here at the moment, but it's a reminder that we live with dangerous bacteria often all around us, without realising it.
I mean, cholera is a disease that just doesn't disappear, and it would be very difficult to eliminate, like, say, smallpox. And in conditions of poor sanitation and hygiene, when you have a natural disaster and a breakdown in your normal public health systems, then these things can very quickly become a problem.
Since cholera was found contaminating water in London in the mid-1800s, we've been zealous at keeping our drinking water pipes separate from effluent and anything else we think might be polluted. That habit's changed since we've started building desalination plants, and we're about to add recycled sewage to drinking water. We're relying more heavily on science and engineering to separate us from the germs, and that needs a lot of high-tech equipment, good science, and skilled people. Water Commissioner Chris Davis.
Just the whole complexity of dealing with this increasingly varied landscape of water sources and water uses and blending and so on just puts the whole national water quality management resource under more pressure.
But do the risks include pathogens potentially breaking through or bypassing the filtering process?
Yes, if there was a failure, if there was a regulatory and a management failure, that certainly could happen. And of course, we see, fortunately, Australia hasn't suffered any of these major outbreaks. But periodically around the world, you get outbreaks of disease like cryptosporidiosis, like E. coli of the aggressive strains. And in Canada and in Sweden and even in the UK, I think recently, there have been outbreaks and they can be very serious. But that's a failure in the regulatory system, and we so far have avoided those sort of massive outbreaks.
We've had no massive outbreaks here, but there have been lots of small ones. Not all cases of food or water poisoning are reported, but those that are supposed to be sent to the National Notifiable Diseases Surveillance Database. There's a link to that database on the Background Briefing website. It shows that so far in Australia this year, there have been more than 7,000 reported cases of salmonella, more than 1,000 of cryptosporidium, 5 cases of imported cholera, and 34 cases of toxic strains of E. coli. Earlier, we looked at non-tuberculous mycobacteria, NTM, in drinking water. The disease surveillance system does have a database for mycobacteria, but it hasn't been updated for a decade. There are 200 to 300 confirmed cases of NTM disease in Queensland every year, and the bugs have been found in hundreds more people being treated for other things. Dr. Rachel Thompson.
It's probably as common as type 1 diabetes in children, so that's diabetes requiring insulin. In the older population, it is much more common, particularly in elderly women. There seem to be a predisposition if you're taller than average or thinner than average. Some would suggest that perhaps these ladies don't cough effectively, and the condition has been affectionately labelled Lady Windermere syndrome because ladies are too polite to cough and they tend to suppress the cough, retain the secretions and help the infection to brew.
Can NTM of itself kill?
It can. It can cause progressive disease. It can cause respiratory failure. And certainly I've had a number of patients in that category.
A woman died last week in Brisbane from respiratory failure and had 2 species of mycobacterium in her lungs, one of which, Mycobacterium avium, was also found in her bathroom tap and in her shower. It's a painfully hard condition to treat. It often needs 12 to 18 months of antibiotics, and there's no guarantee of a cure. Jeanette Dougal, who's in Greenslopes Hospital with Mycobacterium abscessus in her lungs, has been in and out of hospital and on and off antibiotics for 4 years. Mrs. Dougal's daughter, Julianne Kylie, happens to be a nurse.
So this has been quite an eye-opener for me as well, sort of watching the deterioration in Mum's condition and her response to the different drugs that I had never heard of before, and drugs that I believe are very expensive as well and not easy to access. I believe that there are other drugs available, but they're not readily available in Australia because they are so expensive, yes.
In fact, in the US, it can cost as much as $100,000 to treat this disease. The antibiotics that are available can make people sick, and Jeanette Dougal's treatment had to be stopped because she lost so much weight.
It's nice to meet you, and I hope the radio program goes well. Oh. It is important, very important. You don't realise it. No, that's for sure. Thank you.
There aren't many new drugs coming out because hardly anyone's doing the research. Rachel Thompson.
There's a lot of money going into the development of TB drugs, but there's very little going into the development of drugs for NTM infections. And worldwide, all of us are having difficulty trying to get interest in supporting research and funding for new drugs for this disease.
That's despite this disease now overtaking tuberculosis cases in Australia. In Queensland in 2008, the Tuberculosis Centre recorded 246 new cases of NTM disease and 130 new cases of TB. It's a similar story across the developed world. Dr. Michael Eisman is an expert in both TB and NTM diseases.
It's an interesting, almost paradox that as tuberculosis has receded here in North America, in Japan, in Australia, and in Western Europe, in all those areas, there seem to be rising numbers of NTM cases.
It's the opposite in developing countries, where TB is running rampant. multi-drug resistant and extensively drug resistant strains called MDR and XDR are causing slow motion national disasters in countries such as Papua New Guinea. Michael Eisman.
With the best of intentions, as we've made medicines available over the last 20 years to the World Health Organization, we've actually driven initially the MDR and now the XDR outbreaks. So it's an immense challenge. And as you described, New Guinea, it's heartrending because TB in those settings isn't picking off just old people, but it's attacking young adults and their children, and it's going to be disabling civilizations.
For most of human history, bacteria have been killing us in droves and disabling civilizations. Think of the Black Death. TB has been called the White Death. Antibiotics have freed most of us from that terror, but now all sorts of antibiotic-resistant bacteria are knocking on the door. Microbiologist Peter Collignon was part of a group that studied 110 people from Canberra who went on holiday overseas to see what bugs they picked up.
And 50% of them were carrying superbugs they didn't have before they left. And they acquired them, in our view, through foods and water. And a lot of those countries, it's both, because you can imagine if you've got animals getting lots of antibiotics, they have resistant bacteria that get in the water that then goes back to the animals, goes to people, but also is used to water vegetables, tomatoes, lettuce, bean sprouts, you name it, that may not be cooked before you eat them. And so this goes all through the environment. These bugs get everywhere, and what we have to do is control them best as source, but also ensure our water supply is as safe as is reasonable.
But there are hundreds of bacteria and viruses and thousands of chemicals to worry about. As we heard earlier, Townsville researcher John Brody stumbled across the herbicide atrazine when he tested the drinking water in some towns on the Queensland coast.
There's certainly detects of chemicals like atrazine, the herbicide, regularly in a number of Queensland coastal cities and towns, and that's basically coming from runoff from agriculture, ending up in the tap water.
Do we know whether the levels detected could have any health consequences at all?
Well, with the existing Australian guidelines, it would say that they're below the health limit, and so they're not meant to affect your health. Of course, some overseas countries have got much lower guidelines than us, for one reason or another, and so perhaps there's some doubt about this. Of course, that's the problem, really. A lot of these chemicals have had limited studies done on them for human health.
You can't test for them all, but there's new technology, bioassays, for instance, that can help tell if there's anything harmful at all in the water. But it all costs money, and it needs skilled staff, something small country water treatment works can struggle to find. Australian Water Commissioner Chris Davis.
People are allowed to operate water treatment plants, in some instances, just coming in off the street. And, of course, the analogy that gets drawn all the time is, you know, how would you like to fly in a jumbo jet with somebody who came in off the street and stepped into the pilot seat and took over? But what we're trying to do now is to actually create a national system of certification minimums for operators of water treatment plants, because they are more and more complex now and you need much greater skills. So we really need to match the complexity of the plant with the skill of the operator.
We've all grown to think that our water and food is sterile, but it's not. Our mothers used to tell us to wash the fruit before we ate it and wash our hands before dinner, but we seem to have lost the habit. Our food and water has never been more tightly regulated, but it's been estimated that 2 million Australians get food poisoning each year. It's mostly our own fault, but in one salad you might have melon from the Northern Territory, tomatoes from North Queensland, a lettuce from the Sydney Market Garden, and prawns from China. They've been picked, washed, packed, trucked, and unloaded by different hands. Food pathologist Patricia Demachelier.
One of the most difficult things to control, I think, along the food chain is people. You can regulate a machine to pasteurise milk much more easily than you can manage someone handling food. And there has to be some responsibility taken at that point as well, particularly as we've got increasingly populations of vulnerable groups, such as the elderly.
As our population ages, more people will fall into those groups vulnerable to all sorts of things, such as mycobacteria. and we still don't know enough about these mycobacteria in our water and why more people are getting sick. Rachel Thompson.
We are seeing more patients with the disease, and I think I'd like to see some form of monitoring from time to time. My sampling of the water was done as a research project, but at the moment we're not doing any routine monitoring to see whether levels of the bacteria are rising or falling. We don't know the effect of floods, droughts, climate change, what that is doing to the numbers of these organisms in the water supply. We know that they like warm, humid environments, which is why we have so much of the condition in Queensland. But what happened in the drought, we thought that perhaps we had a fall off of numbers of patients culturing these organisms. What will happen now that we've had a flood? Who knows? But that's something that we'll certainly be looking at.
But hardly anyone else is looking at it. Background Briefing has been told that there are no bugs to speak of at the kitchen tap in our drinking water. And yet these mycobacteria are there. Australia's drinking water guidelines say there's no proof that mycobacteria in drinking water can cause disease, but there is evidence that it does. Dan Spiller from the South East Queensland Water Grid says there's a constant debate in the industry about what's a high risk and what's not, but in the end, water utilities rely on those guidelines.
Once it is in those guidelines, though, we take a very diligent risk-based approach to understanding what exactly is in our water in southeast Queensland, how does that vary by source across the region, and how best do we manage it to achieve the guidelines.
But has this particular mycobacterium slipped under the radar?
I think the key for us is that you need to acknowledge there's a very wide range of mycobacterium. What is actually very encouraging about this is that there are researchers looking at specifically this mycobacterium, creating a thesis, testing that thesis, and that goes through the scientific process to determine whether or not that is an issue of concern for us.
Since Background Briefing started asking questions about mycobacteria in the water, some authorities have started taking a closer look at Dr. Rachel Thompson's research.
I think at the moment what we've done is identified, yes, there is a problem and that there is a link between water and disease, and now we need to say, well, what can we do about that? And do we need to do it on a widespread scale where we treat everyone's water, or do we just treat the water of those who are affected? But we need to work out exactly what does kill them, what is effective in killing mycobacteria. But I think given that it is an environmental pathogen and it is something that is found in our water supply, we do need to keep an eye on what's going on.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research by Anna Whitfeld. Technical producer, Philip Ullman. Background Briefing's executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Ian Townsend, and you're listening to ABC Radio National, and you can follow Background Briefing on Twitter.
Australian female boxers are winning world titles. But what's it like to punch another woman?
See, I have it in my head that it doesn't actually hurt them. And they wouldn't step into the ring if they were really bothered by it. I don't feel like I'm just hitting someone. I feel like we're having a dance more than anything.
Discipline and pain on this final frontier of feminism. On 360 Documentaries, stories of people, places and ideas. You can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.